This is the Amp Hour Podcast, recorded January 4th, 2011. Episode 24, The Detroit Debunking.
Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Dave Jones from the EEV blog.
And I'm Chris Gammel from Chris Gammel's Analog Life.
Hey Chris, how you doing?
Good, Dave. Happy New Year.
Yes, you too, and all of our audience. Happy New Year.
Yeah. So it feels like last year.
Yeah. How long have we been doing the show now? In terms of what's this show? 24? So it's 24 weeks. Almost half a year.
Yeah, wow, that's crazy.
That is insane. You're only 5 minutes late today, I see. So if we round down, uh-huh, then you're actually on time.
Well, go me. I must have turned a corner in the new year.
Oh, awesome. New Year's resolution, huh?
There we go. Yeah, yeah.
Yep. Turn up on time for the Amp Hour. But granted, you do have to drive home from work, whereas I'm just sitting here lazily eating my breakfast. So pretty easy for me.
Yeah.
But that's an interesting question. Should we round up or round down? Because you're smack on the five. If you're on the four, I was going to say, we could round down. But yeah, I might
have to count it against me this time. Sorry. I'll try harder next time.
Yeah. Well, someone on the forum, my recent LCR meter review, somebody talked about that. They noticed. I don't think I noticed at the time, but I'm going to have to go back and check the video. But they noticed that the LCR meter display wasn't rounding correctly. Because when you hook it up to the PC, it extracts extra digits out of the thing. But it can only display 5 digits. It can only display a count up to 40,000. And he noticed. I'm not sure if he's correct or not. I've got to check. But he said it was rounding it wrong or something. So he wasn't quite sure what was going on there. So that's an interesting question. If your instrument can measure more than it's actually displaying, then how do you round it? I guess you to use the typical five, right, and go up and go down on the lower side of five.
Yeah, unless you're doing like a ceiling and floor kind of thing, because isn't it ceiling?
Yeah,
isn't ceiling where it's like anything above zero, it goes to the next digit.
It goes to the next digit exactly. So maybe that's the algorithm they're putting.
That'd be weird
place.
Though. I wouldn't do that for an LCR meter.
No, I wouldn't either. I would just do your traditional, you know, five you round up and four you round down, and that's
I'm sure
there's a name for that. Is there an official name for that kind of rounding, half rounding, or something? I don't know.
I would just call it rounding.
I just made it up. Yep.
I don't know.
I'm sure there is a name for it.
I mean, maybe they just don't care about those last digits. Maybe it's just all noise, anyways.
Right. Well, that's the thing. This was brought up on the forum by this person. He said, because this meter, when you hook it up to the PC, it can extract a whole bunch of digits. It can extract an extra 2 or 3 digits out of the thing. What use are those digits? You know, let's say you've got a 6-digit meter. What use are those 6 digits having them on the display if your meter's only accurate to 3 digits, for example? Why have the extra 3 digits? And it's a good question.
If I had a guess, I'd probably guess it was like a single precision kind of thing. Like if it has a single floating point precision internally, and then when it does a conversion, it just says, hey, I have these digits, but it doesn't mean the hardware necessarily supports it.
So. Not necessarily, that's true, but multimeters are a classic example of this. When you get a very high precision bench meter, it might be, say, plus minus 100 counts or something like that. So why have those extra 2 digits? Well, the answer is the difference between accuracy and resolution. Resolution is useful even if your accuracy is totally out, you know, totally crap, right? You can have a 10% accurate meter, but you can have a 6-digit resolution, and that can be useful for getting comparative relative measurements between one component and another component, for example. So those digits are actually useful, even if the accuracy is totally pointless, because, you know, its accuracy is 3 or 4 digits above that or something. So, that's the answer to the forum question anyway. Resolution, those extra digits can come in useful. So
if only we had some kind of time measuring mechanism so we could round up or down.
Right. Anyway, I've done a video on that, talking about counts and all that sort of stuff, and plus minus counts on meters and things like that. So, yeah, what have we got on today's show? That was the first item. That was I just added that like 5 minutes before we started.
Jumping the gun. Yes. You just wanted to talk about your review, didn't you?
Oh, I did. I did.
It was a good review. I liked it. I liked it.
Thank you. Oh, they're getting too long. I mean, what do people think about 30-minute product reviews? People are obviously watching them. I've already had like 3,000 people watch it, and that doesn't include the podcast people. So people are actually watching these half-hour reviews. But
well, I don't know. Can you tell people are actually shutting it off early? That would be the real measure, right?
You can tell their attention span. I haven't really gone in and analyzed that
might be worth
as
doing
much.
That.
But yeah, it might be worth going in. But people are certainly starting it. And they know it's 35 minutes long. It tells you up front, you know, that it's how long it is. So people are watching. But I just can't seem to do a bloody review under half an hour these days. It's crazy.
It's that off-the-cuffness. That's the problem.
That's the problem. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just like to be wordy. My style is a conversational style.
Right.
I guess, what can you do? Mm. Oh, well.
Yeah. So, let's see. To start out, we got a shout-out to SparkFun.
SparkFun, yes.
Innovative new idea known as pick the junk up off the trash bin and sell it to people.
It's a pick-and-place grab bag is what it is, basically. And it's
I
awesome.
Love it.
Yeah,
I know. It's so great. I mean, I don't really know all the range of the parts that they're using. I don't think they're using any like high-precision parts or anything like that. But, I mean, they use enough parts that are, you know, you're probably getting some op amps and some transistors in there and everything. So why not? And if people don't know what we're talking about, basically a pick-and-place machine might have you know, like the suction when it picks up a part and tries to put it, place it on a board, it might fall off, or, you know, maybe it just rejects the part before it even tries to do that. All that stuff goes into just a bin where the rejects go. And that's what they sell you. They sell you a bag of that stuff for $10. So pretty cool. I bet they'll sell out of those, to be honest.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. People will grab those, no pun intended. And these, if you don't know about these pick and place machines, you've typically got it, especially for the real cheap throwaway items like your resistors and your capacitors. You can't give your manufacturer a reel of 100 resistors and expect them to populate 100 boards, because they're going to want some excess components. So when they wind the thing on, a few excess components will fall off. You know, it might be 10 or 20 or something like that. So you've actually got to provide excess components to them. And if you've got really expensive components that are, you know, if a chip is, you know, $100 a pop or something, and you happen to have a reel of 1,000, well, you know, you don't want them to be wasting those particular chips. So you've got to tell them that they're actually, you know, expensive items. Please be very careful about how you reel them and put them on the machine and don't waste them, kind of thing. So, yeah, but that's something you've got to watch out. And all these things end up in the grab bag. It's
it's cool. I like it.
It's a bin of components. It just looks awesome.
There is this one. When I was looking through, I think we did an episode on here about where to find parts. I remember someone linked us through to this really, it was a ham page, and it's just this guy. I think he might be in Jersey or some, I'm not sure where he is, but it's just like his own little grab bag of, you know, he just mixes up components and sells them. And it's the same kind of thing, but his are even more, you know, his might have like through hole kind of components, like big wound inductors and all that other kind of stuff. So
yeah,
it can get crazy though.
I always love grab bags. When I was a kid, you know, you go into Dick Smith or J Car and you'd go straight for the grab bag bin. They used to have a big bin where they'd have, you know, smaller bags of these junk, you know, just excess components. And they were great. That was a great way to stock your lab. And I've still got, you know, tons of those components from, you know, 25, 30 years ago. Not sure how good they are now, but I've still got a lot of them. And, yeah, it's just a great way to generically stock your components. I don't know how long you're going to have to spend sorting through them, because to make them useful, you really got to sort them out. And if you've got things like resistors and capacitors, especially the capacitors, which won't be marked, you know, you'd have to go through and individually measure each one. And, well, that's more trouble than it's worth. You may as well just go out and, you know, buy them in strips from, JCar or from DigiKey or something like that. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, especially with, non-leader and everything.
Tempting,
and,
but only if you've got a lot of free time and you just enjoy
sorting
through bags of components. Mm.
Especially, if you got some good op amps in there and everything, I think that'd really be worth it. But.
Oh, it'd be useful, yeah. And other components which are marked, you know, if they're marked components, great. Not a problem. You know, you can sort them out pretty easy.
Yeah.
Mm.
Well, we like it, Spark Fun. Keep it up. That's cool.
Yeah.
Let's see. What else we got? So we had a suggestion for a rant. That's a new one.
A suggestion for a rant.
Basically, it's from one of our listeners. I've lost who it is. I'm sorry. They're anonymous because they have to
Joe
be
blogs.
In this case. Yeah. Basically, he's been working on and off, whoever this was, and he wants to use like the IEEE kind of services that are out there and everything, and he can't because he doesn't have money for a membership now. So what the hell is he supposed to do? And because that, you know, IEEE has some good resources for, you know, people looking for jobs. They post jobs all the time. And they didn't waive the fee though, because he has to be making less than $13,000, I think.
Mm.
His
argument is that it costs more than $13,000 to actually live. So
doubly so for where the majority of electronics people in the US live, you know.
Right.
If you're in California.
Oh, yeah, because you're going to be living in Silicon Valley or something, right?
Right,
so,
yeah.
Mm.
$13,000 might... They might want to revise that number upward. That might be an old number.
Right.
But it's kind of ridiculous. They should have, like, some kind of...
discount for unemployed people. How do you prove you're unemployed, though? Is there a...
Well, you can... I mean, if you're in the U.S., you have to file for unemployment, so there's tons of paperwork for that stuff.
That's if you're getting unemployment benefits. But I've been unemployed before, and I didn't claim unemployment benefits out of principle and all that sort of stuff. So, what do you do in that case? I guess you're screwed, right?
I don't know. Maybe a letter from a former employer or something?
Right. Anyway, I reckon the IEEE, get on the case, IEEE. I reckon you should have a very heavy discount for unemployed people.
Yeah. Especially these times, you know, like...
Mm.
IEEE.
But then again, if you're unemployed for like a month, do you jump in? Oh, quick, I'll jump in and renew my IEEE membership, and then bang, you get work again, and then...
Well, you could do a month-to-month basis or something. I don't know. There's a lot of things you could do.
I'm sure.
Or even just open up certain things that people that are unemployed would need, right? You don't need to necessarily be reading journals, but you might need access to the boards or, you know, other kind
of
things like that. So
yeah. In fact, they should probably give free access to engineers who are unemployed, especially if you're a previous member and you're now, you've proven that you're in the industry, you're a previous member, and now you happen to be unemployed and you're desperate for work, and your subscription expires, they should give you free continued access to the jobs board. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, anyway. No.
Hopefully they'll figure it out. I don't think they're listening. No, not listening.
Nah, of course
if
not.
They would have, blown their top already for the other things we've said about them.
Right. Speaking of California, you've put here that California is getting rid of the old 100-watt light bulb.
Yeah, I saw that on Cree's Twitter page today. I had known about this because Germany had did it.
Yep.
they had outlawed 100-watt incandescents a while back.
Well, that's the same here. We've had that for a long time now. I think at least a couple of years they banned sale of incandescent light bulbs here, which is just crazy. But,
I mean,
anyway.
There's no negative effects from that, right?
Oh, well, the problem with it is that they went stupid and they did this complete blanket ban on all incandescent bulbs, you know, even when they're used in special niche applications, like, you know, you need a light bulb that goes in your oven or something like that. It needs to be special high temperature bulb, right? You can't just put a compact fluoro in there.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Why does everything taste like mercury? Oh. This is weird.
There's just better ways to encourage people to move over to compact fluoros and other low-energy light systems than to simply just flat-out blanket ban the old ones. It's just... It's pointless, you know? People are just going to stock up on the old ones anyway, and they're just going to continue to use them out of protest rather than encourage people by, you know, just banning something doesn't...
Yeah, I'm not sure if we talked about it on here. The guy in Germany, though, that was... Did we talk about that on here? The guy in Germany that was selling 100-watt heaters, he got them reclassified.
No.
He got 100-watt light bulbs reclassified as heaters.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. They just happen to output light. And, I mean, if you've ever put your hand over a 100-watt light bulb before,
yeah.
It's pretty, you know, like,
bloody hot.
That's the basis for an Easy-Bake oven, right?
Absolutely. Very clever.
So I wonder if that's going to happen. Maybe that'll happen in the California now, but...
Yeah, people stock it. You'll find the same. Have they actually banned them? What is the...
They've banned the 100-watt, not lower wattage bulbs,
right,
though.
Okay.
And then the rest of the US is going next year, so...
Right. No, they'll just find... Same thing here. People will just stock up on them and... Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, you got like a closet full of them at home, Dave? Is that...
No, I don't know.
Are you admitting this on air?
No, I'm not a closet incandescent fan. No, I switched over to compact fluoros totally. Years ago. Oh,
yeah, last year for Christmas, that's what I asked for. Oh, really?
Yeah. Wow. Oh, at least half a decade ago, I switched. Wow. No, more than that. God, 7-8 years ago, I switched over to compact fluoros.
Nice.
Haven't looked back.
Yeah, that's good. That's really good. Well, that's good because you're not throwing stuff out, too. I mean, less... I guess the CFLs have problems with throwing stuff out. You know,
they're,
all the mercury.
Well, I was going to do a blog on that. CFLs are notoriously unreliable. The components in them, just the way they run them, and they overstress them, and they don't survive in heat. These things are, they advertise them as 10,000 hours life on the box or whatever, but what they don't tell you is that is in free air standing at room temperature. With airflow, if you put these compact fluoros in an enclosed enclosure with no airflow, they will die extremely quickly. You know, 1,000 hours, you know, hundreds of hours, something like that. So they're very susceptible to high temperature. So just be careful.
Yeah, you know, I've looked at the block diagram too before, because I mean, you actually have to, for the fluoros, you have to like step up the voltage, don't you? I mean, they actually have like a step up transformer inside, correct?
To actually arc them over, yes.
Right. Yeah, so I mean, like, if people out there have never looked at the block diagram, I'll try and post a link to it, but you know, it's a pretty standard step up transformer inside of it, and then they have to, and I think there's some kind of, there's an LC tank in there. I'm trying to find it right now, but the you know, it's these kind of components are normal electronic components, not just a wire, like a tungsten wire like an incandescent is. So there's a lot more going on in there, and that's a lot of the failure mechanisms come from those actual components failing, as opposed to the, you know, the, there's no filament to burn out.
Yeah.
It's not like the gas is escaping the tube. It's just the thing that strikes the plasma isn't there. So.
And then of course because they're quite an expensive item back when they first came out, you know, you pay $15 for one of these compact fluoro bulbs, and that's when the Wan Hung Low factory swung into action and thought, aha, we'll get some of this market action, and all these poor quality CFLs came out, and they would literally disintegrate in your hand. They were physically just crap. Oh yeah, you go to screw them in and they wouldn't even survive being screwed in. They would just shatter, and just really horrible physical quality as well.
Yeah,
and,
I've noticed that when I've cracked one open before. You look at the actual components, and it's like the cheap Bakelite kind of looking boards.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
You know,
nasty
really
stuff.
Junky looking caps. And
yeah.
But that's how we get them for $3, and that's what we demand. So
exactly, yeah. Market's got itself to blame, I guess. And
yeah.
Then there's the other interesting concept where these bulbs flicker. Have you ever had that? Your switch is turned off, but you're like every 5 minutes or something, your bulb might just go flick. And it flicks on for half a second. A little tiny flash. You can notice it at night.
No, I've never seen that.
No, okay. Well, it doesn't happen to everyone. It's only due to specific home installations. And what it is the capacitance in the wiring, okay, is enough to leak some charge and actually charge up the CFL bulb. Even though the switch is off, okay, the capacitance wiring in your roof couples through to the CFL bulb, charges it up until it gets enough energy to go flash, and then it arcs on for, you know, half a second or something like that, and then switches off, and then charges up again. So you might find these bulbs actually flicker at a rate of once every minute or once every 10 minutes or something like that. So, yeah, it's a very, very obscure kind of problem.
That is kind of Yeah. And that's not just for higher voltage, like 240, like Australia?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I think it happens in the US as well. So it's due to the capacitance of the wiring. So, yeah, I'm not sure if there's any difference in 110, but yeah, it certainly does happen. But it is bulb specific as well. Only some certain bulbs are susceptible to it, and certain house wirings. But you put the combination together, and yeah, you have all these reports of these lights mysteriously flickering in the middle of the night, even though they're switched off. And people think their house is possessed, and they call in, you know, they call in the Ghostbusters. And,
yes. I wonder how many times capacitance has been. Blamed on ghosts or ghosts.
Yeah,
have been,
the other way around. Capacitance is highly underrated, I think, as a phenomenon.
It's the specters and the spooks.
Yeah, everything has capacitance. So
yes, yeah,
indeed.
So I wanted to mention the throwing out of the CFLs because there's been like a I don't know. You kind of see trends about stuff, and I've been seeing more trends just about like electronic waste. I saw there's an E Times article. I heard an NPR story. All this kind of other stuff. And just kind of how it's and you heard it like a couple years ago too about, you know, these huge junkyards in other countries in China and Africa.
Oh yeah.
Where all this stuff ends up, but it's kind of resurging again. You know, it's a topic that keeps going on, and someone was even talking about it on the EEV blog forum. So I thought it was interesting just to see what's going on in the regulation market, because that affects people doing electronics directly with Rojas, and then if people actually care about the implications of having all this electronic junk laying around, because it's not good. It doesn't just disintegrate.
No.
Unlike those light bulbs.
Those light bulbs are pretty simple. That, electronic components, they've got all sorts of nasty chemicals in them. That's what ROHS, everyone thinks ROHS is, or ROS compliance is just about lead, but it's not. It's about all these other, I think there's 5 or 6 different chemicals that actually, it actually controls, so
yeah, and they know, pop it up every year too. Yeah. I mean, they keep adding more things to the list, basically.
To the list of stuff, yeah, exactly. That reminds me, have you heard about the story of stuff?
The story of stuff. Is this a bedtime story, or what kind of story are we talking about here?
It's a video. It's an online video done by this chick, formerly from Greenpeace, I think. Don't quote me on that. And she does these really interesting videos, not always 100% correct, very quite sensationalized, but they're excellent cartoon-type videos exposing stuff like this. And the latest one that's just come out, I've been waiting 6 months to see it. They've been hyping it for like 6 months, and it talks about exactly this. What do you do with your electronics waste? You know, where does it go? How does it? And I'll have to post the video. And it's incredibly popular. And these things, her videos get millions of views. You know, they just go viral every time she brings out a new one. And they're fascinating. So we'll definitely link to that. The story of stuff.
Storyofstuff.com.
Storyofstuff.com. Yep.
Yes.com.
Yep. Storyofstuff.com.
storyofelectronics.org, and that's a new one too, and maybe that's the reason this is coming up again.
That is the new one. I didn't know they had a dedicated address for it, but yeah, that's the one. That's a video. It's well worth watching. I haven't sort of gone through, and once again, they don't just do the video, they provide references to everything they say in the video, so
unlike us
unlike us, we just bullshit away.
Oops. I know the interesting thing I was listening to on NPR about that was just how the way they get like the gold out and all the precious metals out of it is not by like, I always kind of envision like you breaking apart boards and trying to like actually pull off traces.
No,
they just light that crap on fire. Yeah. I mean, like,
they just burn the whole damn lot.
That is not a good idea. That stuff is nasty.
Well, it's fine in China, isn't it? No one cares about China or India or wherever else they're doing it. I'm being sarcastic, by the way. I'm holding up the sun.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, that's what the story of stuff video talks about in several of the videos. Is that, you know, because we don't have the problem here. We ship everything, all of our waste overseas, and all of your recycled stuff or your recycled electronics. You think you're doing good? It goes overseas to be, you know, burnt in somebody's village over there, you know, and they're the ones who get polluted and get cancer
and everything else.
It's just, I know.
Well, another question that comes up too is like, you know, we talk about some of us not to bring up a sore topic, talk about printable electronics, but there's even but just to bypass that subject completely, but you know, like biodegradable type electronics, you know, if you do have a printable, like even a printed circuit board, right? We do that with etching right now. But if you start getting other conductive materials that you can put down on a PCB that maybe is, you know, not as speed sensitive as the fastest things, but you know, you just need a run of the mill board, maybe you can start making those biodegradable kind of materials.
Yeah, possibly. I don't know about biodegradable, but certainly not as harmful. You can definitely do that. Because, like, all the major Dell and your Hewlett-Packards and all those sort of companies there, and Apple with their iPhone now, everything, they're even advertising that all their products are designed with, you know, 30% recycled plastics, and they're designed not to be hazardous and for when you dispose of them and all that sort of stuff. And things are definitely happening there. I don't know if that'll get to a point where electronics is going to be biodegradable. I don't think that's possible, but
in this article I'll link through from EE Times, there's one from ST Micro and then this group out of Switzerland called DeBiotech, and they're working on it basically. That's the kind of thing that they're working on. So I think we're still in the very early research stage, but it is a possibility at least. I don't know about economic viability, which is
Your board might biodegrade, but I don't know about your chips and everything else. So.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, you know, there's lots of components in there that just, you know, your physical connectors and your mounting hardware and all that. You could, I guess, you could, you know, mounting hardware can be made out of biodegradable material, I guess. Stuff like that. Maybe shells for connectors. I don't know. But, yeah, there's a limit to how much you can do there. But everything helps, so that's good research.
Yeah.
Well worthwhile. Yeah.
I don't know. I saw another article about the... I've seen a couple articles, if you couldn't tell.
Right, yeah, you love reading articles. We know.
Yeah. So I saw another one about how... It was from it was a weird source. It was from the Omaha Times. I don't remember where I saw it from.
Right.
Omaha Times or something like that. But just talking about all the different things that microchips are in these days. And it kind of seemed like a lot of people who listen to this are very well versed in electronics, right? But this seemed like more of a layperson's explanation of where microchips are going and why they're in different things. And it kind of struck me as, you know, they're talking about, oh, well, there's microchips in everything, and that's because they all need these things. And it struck me as, no, there's kind of microchips in everything because they don't know what else to do with them, and they're really cheap.
They add functionality, though. They add smart functionality, which is important.
The application software adds functionality, right? Having a chip in there by itself, I don't know. I mean, yes, you're right that it does add the potential for functionality.
Yeah.
But like, if you just put a microchip in something and then you write some 2-bit program, there's no, I mean, well, who cares, right? Put a switch on there.
You can make it smart. So instead of, you know, if you've got a little kid's toy that flashes an LED, right, instead of having a simple, you know, transistor circuit that just flashes it on and off, if you put a 10-cent micro in there, then you can do all sorts of funny patterns with it. You know, it's one of those you start putting an intelligent device in, you do change the game a bit. So
you do. But what's the point of that, I guess? Maybe that's not question to ask. I mean, we're talking about putting, like, microchips in tombstones, you know? It's like, really?
Why not? I kind of think that'd be fun. Imagine my tombstone. Have a video screen up there, and it just keeps replaying the blog. I mean,
do we have to go visit Grandpa? He's really loud.
And he talks funny.
Oh, dear. Well, I mean, I'm guessing you wouldn't. Do you sound funny for an Australian? I don't know. I mean.
I kind of do, I guess. Not as funny as
you
some.
You sound
it's
funny.
Like, I'm probably, I guess, right. deemed fairly normal, I guess, right. compared to some more ochre. accents. Ocker's the word.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
More stereotypically Australian accent. Like, good day, mate. Yeah. How you doing, mate?
Wow.
something really exaggerated
like
that.
Let's not do that again.
I'm not that bad.
Let's not do that again.
Right. That was a bit. That did I actually peak there? Let's no, I didn't. I didn't
it
peak.
Peaked
but...
my interest in canceling the amp hour.
Right, but I guess it needs some high pass and some low pass filter in there. So.
Oh my goodness!
I guess you got the same in the US. You know.
And, yeah, you're right. You're right.
You know, those some of those southern accents are a bit.
Yeah. Oh, speaking of the South, ooh, you're segue. Right. I was just waiting. Let's let Dave go until we find a segue. So TSMC, they announced today they're building a plant in Mississippi. They're building a solar cell plant. My bad. They're building a solar cell plant in Mississippi.
Well, they've kind of missed the boat, haven't they? China's got the market sewn up.
Right. Here's the thing that's killer about that, though. This is basically the equivalent, in my opinion, of like Honda or Toyota, right? Honda and Toyota are brilliant Japanese companies. Some would say otherwise because of Toyota's recent problems. But they, you know, I'm still giving them the benefit of the doubt.
They are great companies.
I mean, like their production system and everything. Everybody knows that, right? But then they basically come over to the U.S. and they build large-scale manufacturing type things like cars, trucks, whatever, because it's much better to build it here, you know, lose some of the local, you know, if they're building it in Japan, obviously they'd pay for labor and everything like that and support the economy there. But instead, support the economy here, build up a brand name based on that, and not have to ship cars all over the place because you have a local manufacturing force. And so now this is equivalent in solar cells.
Right, because they're getting so high, and they're actually quite big. You know, you get these huge panels you're putting on your roof to power your house. They are physically huge.
And heavy. So, I mean, like shipping on that would be...
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is a big... Yeah. I think it's a big deal. I mean, it's not as good as, say, a research and development team being in the U.S.
Yeah.
And then building a fab here and doing that kind of thing. But at the same time, it's better than nothing. And,
of course. I agree. It's a big thing. I guess you could claim it's a problem because it's not an American-owned company. It's the same here in Australia. You know, somebody comes and opens a plant here, great, but it's not Australian-owned, you know.
Right.
So the profits go back overseas. But anyway, yeah, everything helps.
Right. And I think the thing that really struck me about it is I don't think – I mean, I think the U.S. is far off from this point I'm talking about, but, you know, the large scale manufacturing in a different country because of shipping costs and all those other things they describe, that's one thing. But I think because Mississippi is so low income and needs this kind of investment, I think it's even close enough to the point where if China's, you know, if they ever float to their currency, which is a different issue, but even as wages continue to rise and Mississippi's are so depressed because of the economy there, like it's starting to reach an inflection point where companies are looking at this and saying, well, maybe it'll be equivalent eventually, and that's just another thing that adds into it. You know, like that the U.S. now might now have low-cost manufacturing.
Right.
Which would be crazy.
It would. You can do certain things locally. Yeah, there becomes a point where it's more economical to manufacture locally because of all the shipping costs and everything you've mentioned. You know, that overcomes the cost of the shipping and everything else and all the other issues. And I bet you they're getting good tax breaks too from the state government. You bet your bottom dollar they are.
Definitely highlighted. Yeah.
Right. Okay. They actually mentioned that in the article, did they?
Yes, they did. Yes.
Right. Yeah. There you go. That doesn't surprise me at all. Yeah. Right. Well, that's the same thing here. States in Australia fight over, you know, a company wants to build something here, and they'll fight over, you know, who can offer the best deal, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, who can bend over the furthest? and take one for the team, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Nah, but it's all good.
Yeah, so that's good news. That's obviously U.S. news.
But that wouldn't strike me as the... there are other states which are struggling more, aren't they?
Oh, I don't know, man. Deep South?
Well, Deep South. There's I think Detroit, that's which is destitute, right?
Right. Yeah, but
they're
I think
they're practically on the verge of, you know, riding in the streets, aren't they, or something?
I don't
if there's
think
any people left.
Why not just go further, Dave? I think they're all zombies by now, right? I don't know where you're getting your info. No, I mean, Detroit's not great, but...
No, it's great. I saw a great doco, The Requiem for Detroit. If you haven't watched it, watch it. It's awesome. They reckon that they're so, like, everything is so, it hits so rock bottom, you know, nobody's got a job, all the industries have moved out, that there's nothing left except they're going to move back to farming. They're actually, all the residents are setting up these little individual farms, they're turning the streets back into farms or something, and they reckon within 10 years, it'll be a farming city rather than manufacturing cars, which I think is brilliant.
That's pretty
absolutely
cool.
Absolutely brilliant. Good on them.
Yeah, I know. I've read some stuff about them recently, too. And actually, it's worth noting, too, that Maker Faire is up in Detroit again this year.
Excellent.
So I'm going to try and get up to that, though. Because, you know, they still do have a very strong car automotive base there.
Really?
Know,
I thought it was dead.
No, I mean, it's hurting, but it's not dead.
Right.
And the design portion, too. I mean, so there's Kettering University up there, and there's, you know, U of M's nearby, and there's a lot of resources up there. So I wouldn't write them out completely, but like you said, with the land use up there, that's a big deal. Mm. So it's an interesting program they're trying up there. I don't know if it's going to work. And I think Flint is actually a bigger one where they have...
Oh, Flint, yeah, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So it's interesting. But we'll link through the Requiem for Detroit too, and the Maker Faire Detroit, because they got a lot of hackerspaces up there. I mean, like in terms of like interest in the area, I think there's a lot of interest. And when comparing to like Mississippi, I don't think those two compare really, because there is still a lot of high tech, like base. It's not as strong as it was, but there's, you know, it just in terms of like the institutions that are there, I think that's a lot stronger. So.
Okay.
And another thing that can't be written off is union labor, too. I don't think they'd want to go to Michigan.
Right, okay.
If you're making solar cells, I think you want to be making them in non-union states.
Right.
That's just a guess. I don't know if they talk about that in the article, but that's just a guess.
I'm sure it's factored in, yes.
Yeah. But go, Mississippi.
Absolutely, Mississippi. Yeah. Oh, dear. How do you spell it?
Mississippi.
I think every U.S. kid's taught that in school, aren't they?
They are. Yeah,
how to
they
spell
are.
Mississippi.
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, God, I can't even say it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's an interesting question. Do cities like that, cities and states like that, which are really struggling, I know there's lots of them in the U.S. and other countries for that matter, do they actually hit a point where... you know, it becomes so attractive for foreign investment or other companies to actually move their stuff there, you know, because they've still got the labor force, people are out of work, they're desperate to work, they want to work, and the states will no doubt offer them massive incentives to come in and build their big plants. And, you know, next thing we know, we'll be seeing an Intel, you know, a $10 billion Intel fab plant in Detroit or Mississippi or something perhaps. I don't know.
Well, Intel did. I mean, they had that $8 billion announcement a couple months back. They pledged over the next couple of years to invest $8 billion in the U.S.
Right.
I think that was Andy Grove, and you know, Andy Grove is very, very big into innovation and U.S. investment and education, all this other stuff.
Oh, well, so, you wouldn't think so from their previous history. They've been setting up everywhere but the U.S. I guess he's had a change of heart now.
Yeah, I'm sure they're going to grow there too. I mean, like, the thing is, there's talent everywhere. You know, there's a lot of talent.
Of course. Yeah.
And if you ignore that, you're even dumber than if, I mean, like, like if you think that, like, you know, like, nationalism in that regard is stupid, you know, like, it'd be better to build. I mean, granted, it's okay still to build somewhere and try and lure workers in. And obviously, that's been the model in the U.S. for the past, 60 years.
right.
But, you know, it's if you're ignoring that stuff, you're. And you're running a company, you probably shouldn't be running the company, because there's a lot of talent out there. So, yeah.
there you go. I just tweeted yesterday, and nothing, total non sequitur here.
Oh, okay.
That Goldman Sachs, who own practically half of the U.S. and the U.S. government, but let's not get into that, they just bought into Facebook now.
Yeah.
Oh, God, they got a finger in every pie. God, now they're into they've bought part of Facebook. Because actually, this is interesting. This is this segues into startup, tech startup companies, actually, because the traditional startup thing, you always, the goal of any startup company was to go public, right? That was the sole goal of a startup company. Everyone becomes rich, bang, you move on to the next, you know, startup. That was the sole goal. Now they reckon that the new thing is not to go public anymore, like Facebook and other companies are now showing. They're trying to hold off on going public as long as humanly possible, and they're doing that by getting this private funding by the likes of Goldman and Sachs, so that companies like Goldman and Sachs can sell private shares to their big business buddies, and then when they become so big they have to go public, then the big business people make the fortune instead of the, you know, somebody else. But anyway, that's the whole idea now, is not to go public anymore. You can actually make your $1 billion or, you know, $100 million by having private funding. So it's a new model.
Whenever I look at that stuff and I see, like, first off, when I see software stuff like that, I know it's like the times that we live in and everything like that, but man, like $50 billion, that's just, it's unreal to me because like, it's software, you know, like, you know, we talk about hardware on this program and I try and like extrapolate in my mind, how would you do that in hardware? And to these days, I don't know, I don't want to sound pessimistic because it does sound pessimistic, but I don't know how you do it these days. I don't know how you start fab, I guess would be, you know, like unless a certain person's predictions come true, right?
Okay, yes.
I mean, but honestly, right? I mean, like, that might be a way of doing that, but...
Yeah, I know. Software is everything, because software adds the layer of functionality, people, you know, that can give you a novel product or a novel idea or, you know, a novel website, in this case of Facebook. And
Right, I mean, it's all
about the software. It's all about the intelligence built into the product, not so much the hardware itself. So, you know, you can still make a fairly big business out of some hardware, you know, some neat little hardware thing or something like that, but it's not going to be a Facebook, you know. I don't think it's going to be that big. So I share your your feelings.
I can't imagine. And I mean, as for the private investment thing, I mean, bootstrapping has always been the best method to do, you know, to on the path to riches, right?
Of course.
If you're going to start a company and you can use your own money, or you can hold off and get some smaller investments, definitely do that, because the more you hold on to, the more control you have, first off, too. I mean, that's definitely one thing. That means that the majority shareholder, if Mark Zuckerberg is the majority shareholder in Facebook, that means he gets to call the shots.
As soon as
they go public to get money, and he's now down to like 2 or 5% shares of the shares, rather, then sorry, buddy. If the public doesn't like your privacy policy, then it's going to change, or not the public, but your shareholders.
Yep.
So that's definitely a reason to bootstrap. I mean, I completely agree with that. I don't know about the private investment. That's up to them.
And if people don't know about the term bootstrap, in this aspect, it basically means to, you know, start off with a small amount of money which you can afford, your own money, don't borrow it, and then make it, you know, sell a few items, and then use the profit on that to build more, and then so forth and so forth, and you slowly build up with no investment capital at all.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's how all smart businesses at the ground roots start up, you know, to come up with some, you know, whiz bang idea and go get venture capital somewhere. That's, you know, it's extremely high risk. All your eggs are in one, but the failure rate there is huge, but the failure rate for bootstrapping is very, very low.
Right. And the other reason is because you're not going to put your money in unless you really believe in it too, right? If you know you have a good product and you're willing to work 20-hour days, you know, to get your idea working, because, hey, you just gave all your money to your business. I mean, of course, you better make it work, or else you're going to go back to doing something else.
Yep.
You know exactly what's... You have all of the skin in the game in that case, so...
Yeah. And it comes down to, like, also we've mentioned before on here, that you don't have to put in huge amounts of capital up front. You know, you don't have to... You can just sell a simple product first that's not perfect, but it gets you bootstrapped. It gets you, you know, gets you some income, which gets you profit, and then, you know, it's, you don't have to go out and spend $100,000 to get a nice molded case for your product, right? That's you know, that can be money down the hole, really, when you can just put it in a square box and sell it and bootstrap it.
Do that in Revision 6. Who cares about Revision 1?
Exactly.
So, since it's 2011, and since you've already gifted me one non sequitur, I wanted to gift one right back. How about, how about some top 100 ridiculous claims for 2011?
All right. Do we have to go through that list? Oh, my God.
Not the whole
top
list.
Top 100?
Oh. No, there's not. Well, there's... No, there's not that list. The other list. There's a list of trends in 2011, and there's a couple I wanted to highlight.
100 things to watch in 2011.
100 things to watch. That's right. That's right. So number one on the list, actually, too, is 3D printing, which I think we've seen a little bit of that in the maker movement and everything else like that.
Yep, absolutely.
So that's cool. Micro businesses was another one. I don't know if you saw that one. And this is all from a company called JWT, and they do this list every year. And and they claim, oh, so much success, and... yada, yada, yada. But micro businesses, I thought that one was kind of cool.
Yep.
That was number 51. And that was basically having all the means necessary to bootstrap yourself. You know, kind of relevant there.
Hmm.
So they think that's going to increase as well. We'll see about that one.
Bamboo? Number 7 is bamboo.
7? Oh, you're only at 7?
I mean, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm not scrolling through fast enough. Beer is number 10.
Well, I had some picked out, so we didn't have to scroll through.
Right, okay, go for it. Sorry.
They mentioned near field because Google's pushing that still a lot.
Yeah, that's going to be big.
That's coming up. And then
it's already big in Japan, apparently, I've heard. Everyone's mobile phone's got near field, and they buy their their stuff from vending machines by swiping their mobile phone or something. I don't know how true that is, but it's what I've heard.
I have confirmation of that too. So.
Oh right, yeah,
yeah, pretty cool. I mean, it's just a matter of the platform now. If Google does it, you're probably going to do it, right? I mean, like I know I will. So that was another one they mentioned, though, tap to pay. So they mentioned near field is like, you know, opening doors and all this other crap.
Yeah.
But also tap to pay would be the thing you talked about. And then the last, and of the 100, I only saw like 4 or 5 that I liked. So the last one I had was self-powered devices. So energy harvesting and all that other kind
of
stuff.
Yeah, all that sort of stuff, which can apply to, you know, very low-powered stuff, watches, things like that. So
right.
Yeah,
yeah, and maybe even other things as
sensors,
power,
you know,
keeps
things,
dropping.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I like number 17. Somebody was thinking there; it's quite novel. Capture advertising.
Oh,
like, you know,
if
you go into, like, if you sign up for a website and ask you to verify if you're human, it's called a capture, and it puts up like an obfuscated bunch of letters. Well, instead of just putting up the letters, how about putting up an ad? So. Yet more ways to make ad revenue. It's just, is there no end to
and Alan Turing is rolling over in his grave. to go from a test that tests it to that checks if you're a robot or not to turning people into robots for brands.
Yep.
Pepsi, it's the one.
Number 24, Detroit. There you go.
That might have been
24.
Where I saw it before. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yeah. There you go. Yeah. What are they actually saying?
I don't remember. I didn't put it on the list, Dave.
they're going to raise the city or something and consolidate the population, create new residential business areas.
They're talking about Flint in that one, I think, really. Because, I mean, they talked about Detroit, but
yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, it's a cool list, but, I mean, the tech-centric things are just meh. Yeah, we've seen some of them. We'll see if I don't know, if near field really takes off. I don't know how much I mean, it's going to take a long time to roll out, you know?
Yeah, it does, but it's eventually going to happen. So
It will. But, you know, like, you know that Visa is going to be pissed, right? Or MasterCard.
Yeah.
All those guys are going to be pissed if Google tries to do this. So
you betcha.
And then they'll impede it. So we'll see.
Yeah. Yes, there'll be wars going on there. So,
yeah.
Anyway,
did you see
that's...
The,
go for it.
No, did you see the predictions that went... Ari on IEEE with Kurzweil and IEEE.
Yes, Ray Kurzweil. If you haven't seen it, we'll put up the link. He IEEE wrote a savage article of him last month.
It's not the cover.
Basically saying, oh, he's a crock of shit. And none of his predictions come true, and he's just, you know, all this sort of stuff. So he actually responded to them. He wrote a letter to the IEEE. No, is it? Yes, it's the IEEE.
Yeah, it's IEEE.
Wrote a letter to the IEEE, and it's pointing out errors in there. Yes, it was quite funny.
I think you and I, Dave. I mean, some of the stuff Ray Kurzweil says is right. A lot of the other stuff is wrong. But
you know,
we should say enough things.
God.
We should say enough things that something's bound to be right, and then we'll just work on, you know, defending what we meant by all the things we said that were wrong.
Of course, you can always come up with a clever defense. Yeah,
that's my plan for the printed chips. Right,
the chip maker machine. Yep.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, what I really meant was it's possible, but it's not economically viable.
Your original argument. You've modified your argument once you realize.
No, that's what I'm saying. You have to modify your original argument in order to.
To massage it into
That's the game. That's the game here, Dave. Yes, we need. So, but if you make enough, it's just the law of large numbers. At that point, something has to be right, and then you could just point to that one over and over again.
Right.
But I was right about near field communications or whatever else you say.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
More predictions. This is a bit. Well, no, not predictions. Sorry, not predictions, but it's an old IEEE article. Some people have been tweeting it. It's a couple of months old. But it's the top 25 chips of all time, and I love it. I love lists like this. And I think
you just love it because you're old. That's why.
I know, because I'm old and I remember them. So, you know, it's great. Where is it? Top 25 chips of all time. I've got it open here somewhere.
There it is.
Here we go.
That shook the world.
That shook the world. 25 microchips that shook the world.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. And, well, let's go through them. And I guess, why not? Hey,
okay.
It's electronics related. We're talking chips. And of course, they don't actually number them.
You'll have to excuse me if I don't know some of them. If I don't know some of them, some of these are, you know, 12 years before I was born. So
Okay.
I'm just going to sit quietly by for some of them.
Okay. Well, the first one, no surprise, the 555 timer or the NE, the Signetics NE555.
Wait. I thought it was 555, Dave.
No, it's 555. Sorry. 555. 555 here in Australia.
Or
yep.
555. What was the last one? There was one more.
The 555 is fine, but it wasn't the 555.
555. Yeah.
The 555 timer.
Yeah.
But no, the 555. It's definitely not the 555. No. Sorry. And they've got a whole story behind each one, which is great. You've got to read this list. It's awesome. We'll put it up. And no surprise, 555, bow, we are not worthy. And the next one I love, which you probably won't remember, is the Texas Instruments TMC-0281 speech synthesizer chip. Now, nobody actually remembers the number. I don't remember the number for that chip, but, you know, it's just the TI speech synthesizer chip is what everyone remembers that. And that's circa 1978. And if you've ever watched E.T., extraterrestrial, he uses the speak and spell
machine. That is my first exposure to this chip.
Right.
It
was through E.T., I'm sure it was, But it was the hottest Christmas item in 1978 or 79 or something like that. So,
yeah,
the speak and spell chip. And that really was game-changing because at the time people went, holy shit, look what chips can do. You know, before that you needed, you know, like everyone knew, you could build a computer with a whole, you know, hundreds and hundreds of chips. But this is when, shit, a chip can speak? Oh, my God, you know, the future's here. It was just that game-changing, I think.
Yeah, I've looked at that chip before, too, because I forget why I was looking at it. But it's actually really interesting if you look at how they built it and like how they built up the phonetics and combined them. So they actually only they had a very small subset of sounds that they could combine together.
Yep.
And it is somewhat intelligible. It's a little different today.
It's a lot different. But it's still based on a similar concept. The speech allophones, the little... little nuances of speech. They've actually done a lot of research. Massive research goes into this about how speech can be broken up into these little allophones.
Right.
And there's other names for them too, but that's how they're using these chips.
And that's coming back too, because there's a big push from Google even, you know, to increase their translation and their text to speech and speech to text kind of stuff.
Exactly, text to speech is it really didn't improve much there in 20 years. I mean, from 1978 to, right, you know, it didn't improve a massive amount. Now it's pretty schmick these days.
Not based on discrete either, though. It's based, I mean, most of it is, you know, based on a CPU that is running at high, you know, high band or high frequency. So
yeah, of course, yeah,
software based. Right.
Yeah. And there's been more research, and combine that with today's computing power and everything else. And yeah,
right, right.
It's starting to come together, but it still sounds like a computer voice, you know, right. So and you can still pick it.
If there was a Ray Kurzweil-esque prediction I'd like to put forward too, it'd be the Universal Translator, because that's what I've actually wrote about that before, because I think that when that point comes, when I can walk into any country and be able to communicate with someone. Yeah, and you know, I pull out this little device that actually lets people know that I'm a stupid foreigner too.
That little device will be called your phone.
Yeah, exactly.
Because everything's phone centric. Nobody has separate devices these days.
Right, right. So that would be mine. I can't wait for that.
And will that be done as an app, or will that have a dedicated voice chip in there? Because there's massive.
I don't care.
Come on. What do you mean you don't care? This is an electronics radio show. Of course you care.
I know.
It to be hardware, don't you?
I want it to be a reconfigurable FPGA. That's what I want.
Oh, it can't be a reconfigurable FPGA. They draw too much power. They're too big. It's got to be a custom.
For now.
It's got to be a custom
device. No way, man. Why not? You can reconfigure for each language. That'd be badass.
Dedicated silicon. Yeah, show me a mobile phone that's got an FPGA in it, you know.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, they don't, because they don't hit the power form. They don't hit the power. They don't hit the density. They don't, you know, they're great for bigger applications that can afford the expense, and B, the power consumption, C, the size, and all the rest of it.
D, the awesomeness.
And, well, yeah, they're pretty awesome that you can reconfigure shit. Yeah. That's pretty awesome. But
I have to say, analog FPGAs are my vice. I like them. I think they're cool.
yeah, they are cool. I mean, you get to a point, you know, you're awestruck by FPGAs at the moment. A lot of people were, a lot of people are. And then you get to a point where you go, well, shit, I can't use them in everything.
Of course you can. I know that.
You know, but, okay, well, you're a step ahead of some people then. Because there's a lot of people out there who think they're the universal solution, and there's people out there who are betting that they're going to be the universal solution.
Oh,
and they're just...
No, I don't think so.
You know, no.
Principal chips, once you prototype it on an FPGA, that is the solution. No. Rolled it back in there, didn't I?
Come on, dude. Anyway, next one on the list. Let's finish the show with this. I think we've only got five minutes left.
Well, yeah. The
6502 microprocessor. Well, because it was 1/10 the cost or something. That's what enabled the Apple One. That's what enabled, you know, Woz to go and build the Apple One. And definitely.
And people still build with them today. You see projects on Make all the time, or Hackaday and everything.
Yeah.
So 6502 are big.
Yep, absolutely. That was a huge thing. Even though it wasn't the first micro out there, but it was very influential because it started Apple. And in the TMS DSP, the first TMS 32,000 series DSP, 1983. That was a big turning point when you could do, you know, a DSP type processing in a device. It didn't have to be done all in software. So,
also a big important event in that year that happened.
I was born.
I was born.
You were born in 1983.
Yeah.
Holy crap, dude. In the 80s?
I know.
Jeez,
man.
I was soldering shit in my workshop, in my lab in 1983.
I can't help how old you are, Dave.
I know. Oh, dear, Eddie. I'm not that much older, but yeah, I started young.
That's good. That's good.
Next on the list.
I was soldering the next year. How about that?
Right. Okay. Awesome. The microchip PIC 16C84. In 1993, Some people, one person on the forum claimed that this wasn't, that their claim Atmel should have been on here because they were the first flash device and all that. But I think, no, the microchip definitely deserves to be on here because it was the first microcontroller that wasn't either UV erasable or one-time programmable. It used E2 PROM. And to do that, you know, to be able to program the thing in circuit was, and you didn't need an very expensive and big in-circuit emulator, yeah, like you had to before these, we take it for granted that you can just, you know, recompile your code, download, boom, 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 you know. Whereas back in the old days, you either had to take the chip out, put it in a UV eraser, or you had to get a big in-circuit emulator, which emulated the whole darn chip. And anyway, let's rush through the list. I think we're at 741. I think our amp hour's up, but I'm going to go through Intercell waveform. Oh, the 8038 waveform generator. Western Digital UART. Everyone takes UARTs for granted, but before the chip came along, the Acorn ARM1. Not everyone knows that ARM processors came from the original Acorn computer back in the 80s, but that's its heritage. So there you go. The first image sensor from Kodak.
CCD,
The Deep Blue chess chip. I'm skipping a couple. 8088 processor, the first MP3 decoder. Yep, it's all there.
Yeah, these are all big ones. Yeah. I don't know. Z80. I like that list.
Yep, it's good. I think it's a good list. I can't think of anything offhand that is kind of missing that was so important that it should have been on there. So I think they did well. Great list.
Kudos to the IEEE, yes.
Yes. Again, even though because do like to bash them occasionally.
We do like to bash them, but they do put us... I mean, like you've said before, their Spectrum is... I mean, the Spectrum magazine has some good stuff. I mean, it does. So, yeah, very nice list. All right,
and
I guess that's
it,
huh?
We're blowing it. That's the first one for the year, folks.
Yeah, and the first one without the... we're sorry for all the workbench of the week we skipped.
Oh, holy crap. we forgot workbench of the week.
Yeah, we'll get them next week.
We did. What did we spend an hour talking about then?
A lot of crap, man.
Oh, jeez. Thanks for joining us, guys.
Yeah, we'll talk to you next week.
See ya.
This is the Amp Hour Podcast, recorded January 4th, 2011. The Detroit...